Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
What is a society? Well, it's a group of people living together in more or less an ordered community. They have common institutions, might have common traditions, and should have common interests. Put another way, a society is a network of individuals who, by virtue of their physical and social connections, make choices, ideally cooperative ones, that have an impact on other individuals across the entire group. So, we, living together in the United States, are a society. There's another important network to consider, and that's the one inside your head. Your brain, and the brains of all 332 million Americans. It's the neural network that governs every individual's existence. It's supremely complex, fantastically sophisticated, lightning quick, highly malleable, and exquisitely vulnerable to external forces, pressures, and experiences. So both networks, social, macro, and neural micro, are dependent upon each other to function smoothly. Or at least I would offer that as a thesis for today. They're dependent on each other to function smoothly and for people and their societies to be well. But what happens when things break down anywhere along that continuum? Well, this can happen.
When you have video footage of people taking bags of ballots and showing that they are for Donald Trump and lighting them on fire.
I helped write a fact check on CNN on that particular video. The election officials said that video has been going around for a few days. They are printout ballots. They're not real ballots.
You use the information of the election officials.
Somebody like me comes along, tries to research it, tries to fact check it. And then I fact check it. You'll come back and say, well, the election officials would say that.
But wouldn't they, though? That's the thing, though. Question everything, right?
And this.
What's the purpose of storming Congress itself?
Because they work for us. They don't get to steal it from us. They don't get to tell us we didn't see what we saw.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. CNN's Donnie O'Sullivan trying in vain in November to convince a voter that there was no ballot fraud and insurrectionists attacking the Capitol in January are just two of the examples of what did happen and what might continue to happen when social and neural networks break down. Under the right kinds of strain, an individual's brain, and therefore the society that that person lives in, looks for a way out, looks for something to hold on to. And that's when it can succumb to authoritarianism. So today, we're bringing together two scholars, an historian and a neuroscientist, to explore a different take about what is happening in the United States right now. We'll try to understand the social and neurological forces that drive people to turn their backs on democracy. And joining us is Tim Snyder. He's a professor of history at Yale University and author of many books, including On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, which is out now in a graphic edition. Professor Snyder, welcome back to On Point.
Very glad to be with you. Thank you.
And also with us is Lisa Feldman Barrett. She's the University Distinguished Professor of Psychology at Northeastern University, also Chief Science Officer for the Center for Law, Brain, and Behavior at Massachusetts General Hospital, and author of many books as well, including How Emotions Are Made and 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. Professor Feldman Barrett, welcome to you.
Nice to be with you.
Okay, so first, let me test my own theory here with both of you. Is there a connection, do you think, between, you know, an individual's neural health, if I can put that, or the functioning of their brain, and what we see when a society as a whole seems to take a turn towards authoritarianism? And Tim Snyder, I'll ask you to test my theory here first.
Well, of course. I mean, and we don't even need 2021 to tell us. There's a long tradition of philosophical thought about this. And, you know, from Plato, who has Socrates say that none of us is self-sufficient, all the way up to Rousseau, who has a book called Emile about how you have to educate people to work in public. We've known for a very long time that if you want to have a complex form of politics, the kind that you described in your introduction, you have to have individuals who are educated in a certain way and who are aware of what they are doing, who have a kind of reflectiveness. Democracy is about reflection. It's about seeing the world. It's about self-correction, which means that it's not at all the default form of politics. Historically speaking, it's quite exceptional. And I think one of the problems we have in America is that we've kind of come to think that freedom just means whatever I happen to think, whatever I happen to be convinced of, whatever I feel like doing at this very moment. And that notion of freedom is highly manipulable by larger forces, by media, especially by social media. And that version of freedom is probably incompatible with democracy because it makes reflection something that we just don't do.
Okay. So that is absolutely fascinating. Professor Barrett, let me turn to you because, I mean, what Tim Snyder just described, reflection, self-correction, are essentially modes of self-regulation that, ostensibly the brain can do and constantly does.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think it's important to say that it's not really about health or illness per se. It's not like, you know, working brains, when they're working well and healthfully, we have democracy, and when they're not working well, we have something else. And there's no specific part of the brain that causes authoritarian thinking or democratic thinking. There's no liberal brain or conservative brain or anything like that. But the brain does function in different modes. And some of those modes are very efficient and allow you to be more self-reflective, and some modes are more expensive metabolically, so they're just, you know, they cost more and they kind of feel not so great. And those, when we get into modes like that for a long period of time, that's when we run into risks like the kinds that we're seeing now, I think.
Okay. So I'm going to come back to something you said about metabolic expense here in just a second. But it sounds like one of the things that both of you are describing is that a well-functioning democracy as a whole requires some kind of or multiple kinds of stability, and you have to work for that stability. I mean, Tim Snyder, is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, if we want to be a little reflective about recent U.S. history and some of the mistakes that we've made as a democracy, we think about the last 30 years since 1989. We had this terrible idea that since communism had failed, there was a kind of historical default, that history was over, there were no alternatives left, there was just capitalism, democracy, capitalism was going to make democracy for us. Therefore, we as individuals didn't really have to do much of anything because these larger forces were going to sort out the world for us. That is precisely an authoritarian attitude. If you take the view that there is a larger force, whatever you think it might happen to be, and that this brings democracy in some kind of general abstract way, you're basically de-educating yourself. You're taking yourself out of history. You're saying it's going to be taken care of for me. Whereas what we actually had to do after 1989, as you always have to do if you want to have a democracy to keep going, is think about the capacities that individuals are going to need to deal with one another in courts of law, in civil society, as voters. It's an ongoing process. The Greeks knew this. Everyone has always known this. The founders knew this. Democracy is an ongoing process, year to year, generation to generation, election cycle, in which you have to keep communicating with each other and keep making ourselves into the kind of people who can work democratically.
Okay, so de-educating yourself, Lisa Barrett, to me that also sounds like a way of reducing stress or strain, right? Because, I mean, if you have to put forth a lot of energy in a system full of uncertainty or disruption, that takes a lot out of you. And so Tim Snyder describes it on a sort of a historical and social level as de-educating yourself as a response to that. So how does that fit into your research into what you call body budgeting? Like, what is that?
Yeah. So I think it's important to understand that that we don't have brains because brains are rational. They allow us to be, rational and controlled in some deliberate way. That's not really the pinnacle of brain evolution. We have brains because brains are important for regulating bodies. And if you look all the way back to, you know, the dawn of when brains evolved, they evolved for the purpose really of, or the most important purpose is to really regulate the systems of your body. So your brain, you could think, is running like a budget for your body, all the systems inside your body. So right now, as we're talking, as our listeners are listening, there's a whole drama going on inside each of us that we're really largely unaware of because our brains are basically taking care of regulating our hearts, our lungs, and so on. And we can talk about it as a body budget. And the brain doesn't budget money. It's budgeting glucose and salt and oxygen and water and so on to keep us alive and well. And the two most expensive things your brain can do is move your body around, like when you're exercising or just dragging yourself out of bed in the morning, and learning something new, particularly in conditions of uncertainty. And so learning something new, something unexpected, particularly when circumstances are uncertain, doesn't have to be a bad stress, Meghna, because a bad stress just means that your brain is preparing your body for a big metabolic outlay that isn't replenished after the fact. But, you know, people who exercise every day know that it's if they replenish what they spend, it's just a good investment. And so education can be that as well.
Okay, so when we come back, I want to talk more about this uncertainty, specifically what it means in both of your fields here, because it's a word that we've been throwing around for a long time, years now, but especially over the past couple of years. And I think it's important to understand that. So we'll do that when we come back. Lisa Feldman-Barrett and Tim Snyder, hang on. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're trying to understand the social and neurological forces that drive people to turn their backs on democracy. And I'm joined today by two scholars, one a historian, the other a neuroscientist. Tim Snyder is with us. He's a professor of history at Yale and author of many books, including Our Malady. And his previous book on tyranny is now out in a graphic edition, just released. And Lisa Feldman-Barrett joins us as well. She's a professor of psychology at Northeastern and chief science officer at the Center for Law, Brain and Behavior, I should say, at Massachusetts General Hospital, author of many books, including How Emotions Are Made. And hop on Twitter or Facebook, we're at On Point Radio, and ask your questions about the connections between our brains and our societies when it comes to authoritarianism. Now, Tim Snyder, let's talk more about uncertainty. I'll talk with both of you, obviously, about uncertainty, because it seems to me that for obvious reasons, authoritarianism, which is essentially a belief system in which you set aside your personal freedom in exchange for guidance and rules and a rubric set by a strong leader, is a perfect antidote to uncertainty. But what kinds of uncertainty in particular trigger a society to move towards authoritarianism? Because we're constantly faced with all manner of different types of uncertainty, but they don't all lead to, you know, a nation turning its back on democracy.
So I want to start by picking up where Lisa left off with the idea of body budgets, because it seems we have a particular problem in the U.S. which bears on this question of uncertainty. When we talk about uncertainty, I mean, uncertainty is not just not being certain about a particular fact. It's also a general condition, right? Like it's a general feeling that we don't know what's going on, that life is too much for us, that we're overwhelmed. And an unusual thing about U.S. politics is that we actually have a system which is structured to make us feel overwhelmed all the time, right? One of the ways that governments handle this relationship between what Lisa calls body budgets and political behavior is they create something called a welfare state. The welfare state provides childcare, it provides public schools, it provides healthcare your entire life, it provides you for a pension when you're old. And the result of this is that day to day, you feel much less uncertain about your day and also about the rest of your life. Because America is flawed and limited in all of these ways, because we don't have these public services, people in this country, compared to other rich democracies, have a lot more uncertainty, a lot more, their body budgets are being tested and withdrawn from in a way which is entirely politically unnecessary. So that's a special way that we generate stress all the time. And during a pandemic, it becomes all the worse. And when this happens, it makes it harder for people to do the basic thing that they have to do in a democracy, which is confront the facts. This then leads, you know, to your point, which is that if you are already stressed, you know, by the lack of public services, by globalization, right, by not knowing what the future is, then a big lie, like, for example, the one Mr. Trump told, the big lie that the people who lost actually won, helps you because it organizes everything. You no longer have to pay attention to the facts. You now have a big story, and all you have to do is just take in what feels right and reject what doesn't feel right.
Mm. Lisa Feldman Barrett, go ahead.
I completely agree with what Tim is saying. And I think it also, the big lie also does something else, which is it gives you a choice between a very simple truth, you know, with air quotes. So a very simple story or chaos. And chaos is, you know, things being completely unpredictable where you don't know what is true is really, really taxing, both metabolically and, you know, psychologically. And I think Tim's point about stability, about a well-functioning democracy giving you stability is really important, because stability from a control theory standpoint in biology or in engineering, stability isn't about everything staying the same. It's not about things never changing. It's about having the resilience to stay on a trajectory. So when, you know, something happens that you don't expect, like a pandemic, you know, that there are resources, both metaphorically and actually biologically, to deal with that change and keep you on this trajectory. But if you know if you're paying little metabolic taxes all the time because things are unpredictable or uncertain, and that can mean in your everyday life, it can mean in, you know, economically, it can mean politically, then what happens is your brain is gonna very automatically gravitate towards simple single answers to issues that are inherently complex. And that is the pathway to authoritarianism.
Okay, so here's where I wonder, I'm gonna just question my own thesis here, okay? Because we've talked, Tim Snyder, you talked about the sort of fact that the United States, almost uniquely amongst Western democracies, like structurally builds in sources of uncertainty because the state doesn't do all it can to take care of people. But in terms of those Americans who have found some attraction to, and I'll specifically say right-wing authoritarianism right now, I wonder if this analysis breaks down a little bit, because I don't see that many, you know, impoverished people of color storming Congress, right? I don't see that many Black Americans or Latino Americans who have to work three or four jobs just to be sure that they can keep a roof on their head or find time to visit the doctor, saying that the election was stolen and that democracy should be overturned. So what is there something distinct about the kinds of Americans or those Americans who find authoritarianism particularly attractive now that goes beyond the, you know, the economic uncertainties that are absolutely a fact of life for millions of Americans?
Yeah, thank you for that wonderful point, which helps me to historicize the claim I was trying to make before about the welfare state. I agree with you completely. There's something going on here which is also historical and also very specific to America. So in the US in the 20th century, like other Western democracies, we did build up something like a welfare state. And that welfare state, as it was structured by compromises in the 1920s, 1930s, 40s, and 50s, was actually largely designed to exclude people of color, especially African Americans. It was largely a project of white people for white people. Now, white people very often didn't notice this. They kind of took for granted the structure of opportunity that was given to them in this country. Then from the 1980s forward, we have generally made political decisions, mainly under Republicans, but also under Democrats, to disassemble that welfare state. And now suddenly white people find themselves with lower life expectancies. They find themselves with greater uncertainty. They find their middle class shrinking. And the last thing that they do in general is say, hey, this is our fault because we voted for the wrong people, right? So you're absolutely right that it's not a matter of objective lack of opportunity or objective poverty. It has a lot to do with historical expectations. And what we've done to ourselves in this country in a particular way is we've set ourselves up for a situation where people who expect more are getting less than they expect, right? That's the crash of the American dream. And so we're at a point where if we want to get back the sense of confidence, we're going to have to do it for everybody this time around. We're going to have to rethink democracy in such a way that democracy involves giving everybody a sense of the kind of stability Lisa's talking about, gives everybody a sense of a future. If we're going to have democracy in this country, it's going to have to start again with everybody involved.
Hmm. So Lisa Feldman Barrett, then I'm thinking of, for example, the extremely wealthy Americans who took their private jets to Washington, D.C. and then stormed the Capitol, right? What kind of metabolic tax are they paying? Or what are the uncertainties in their lives that are resulting in the metabolic tax that might lead to this behavior?
Right, that's a really great question. So the first thing I just want to say is that I'm really not reducing everything to metabolism. I'm basically saying metabolism and brain metabolism in particular is just one factor in a very complex soup of factors that often gets overlooked. Mm-hmm. And I think the point that Tim is making about that people come to expect certain things, and when those expectancies are not met, that's a, you know, it's a motivation to act. And I think that's also correct. But I would also add that in addition to all the political uncertainty and the, you know, difficulties that come from, you know, economic hardship and so on, there's also day-to-day ambiguities that are built into American life and that make our body budgets just a little harder to keep in balance, like the casual brutality of everyday life where people speak to each other, you know, in ways that you don't know if those harsh words are a greeting of friendliness or a threat to your physical well-being. And, you know, we can't use salty words on air, so I won't give you specific examples. You know, there's a certain degree of social isolation that everyone is experiencing, even people who are very wealthy. And, you know, we are social animals. We evolved to have socially dependent nervous systems. So you don't manage your body budget on your own. Other people you know, metaphorically make deposits and withdrawals. And one thing that seems important here is that, you know, when you join a social movement, that gives you a bunch of, you surround yourself with people who are like-minded, who think the way that you do, whose behavior is very predictable to you, because you're predictable to them. And that actually gives your body budget a bit of a break. You know, it makes it just easier to get through the day when other people are very predictable to you. Because in the end, the best thing for a human nervous system, for your body budget, is another human. But the worst thing also is another human. And being around people who are unpredictable or who believe things that you don't believe, therefore makes them unpredictable, is actually, you know, you pay some metabolic taxes for that. And it doesn't really matter how monetarily impoverished or enriched you are. You'll pay that tax. Mm.
Okay, so this is really interesting, Lisa, when you talked about both the best and the worst thing for an individual is other individuals, being around other humans. I have to ask, because Tim, when you talked about essentially what are kinds of manufactured uncertainties in American life, whether they're institutional or economic, we should also talk about the uncertainties, the quote unquote uncertainties that people's brains are flooded with every day due to media and social media, right? I just can't think of perhaps another more potent force when it comes to dysregulating our understanding of the world than the kinds of things that people see in the media and online. It's also another manufactured uncertainty, is it? Is it not? Because it's not actually connected to the quality, the tangible, measurable quality of any one individual's lives, right, Tim?
I agree completely. Before I pivot there, I just want to confirm something that Lisa said. I mean, because of course we can't explain everything, you know, metabolically. Yeah. Radical wealth inequality in the United States is a tremendous problem for democracy, and one that everyone, you know, again, from Plato forward has seen as a problem. And in my, you know, humble experience with this sort of thing, it's definitely the case that becoming extremely rich does not make you more open to other people's perspectives. You do get used to hearing what you're used to hearing. Pivoting to social media, I think there's an interesting thing going on here, which is negative in both ways, because on the one hand, social media is a great stressor. Right. It's because the way that attention is kept on the screen is that you're given a combination of things that you're going to find welcoming, and then every so often something that you find terrifying or frightening, because the algorithms, quote unquote, know, or rather the programmers, the software engineers know that it's that combination of affirmation and trauma which keeps people online for the longest period of time. And since the entire model of this network, which is a third network, in addition to the two you mentioned at the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. This is not society and it's not our brains. It's something which affects both our societies and our brains. And it's a different, very powerful network. The way it's set up is to give us as much attention as possible. For you know, so that advertisers can make profits. So in that sense, it's a big drain on us physically, right? It's very hard on our bodies to just kind of sit and be fixated by this the whole time. On the other hand, it does give us predictability, right?
Yes.
Because social media categorizes us along with other people and invented people and bots and fakes and so on, who express the same kinds of opinions. It makes us more predictable as well. It erodes us. It takes our rough edges off. It gets us into some kind of a stream where it seems like everything that happens is consistent with our view. So if we go back to the top of the show and that gentleman who said he saw what he saw, but he didn't see it in real life. It was served up to him on social media as something that social media understood would be consistent with what he already believed. And so in this way, social media is terribly predictable. It takes us away from the facts of the world, and it gets us into the mode where we think, huh, I know that I'm right, and therefore anybody who disagrees with me must be an enemy, must not be a real American.
And this is why the media has always been one of the favored tools of authoritarian leaders. Right, Tim?
I mean, it's the problem with what's new with social media is that, you know, it's unfortunately automatically authoritarian. Right. So, I mean, it's always been the case, as you say, that new media have been exploited for authoritarian or tyrannical purposes. Right. So so the radio was a favorite technology of National Socialists, and film was used by communists. The problem with social media is that the very way that it works tends to make us function like people who want to belong to a tribe. And then it's like social media is just setting it up for someone like Trump to come along, who's basically a kind of henchman to social media. Social media is preparing the way for the person who kind of rides in at the last moment and takes advantage.
Well, as you said, the algorithm itself may pave the way to authoritarianism. So Tim Snyder and Lisa Feldman Baird, I'm definitely going to want to hear you on this after we come back from a quick break. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're trying to understand what goes on in an individual brain, and therefore across societies, when people decide to turn their backs on democracy. And interestingly enough, our information environment has a lot to do with this. And tomorrow's show, we're going to be focusing specifically on social media and how Facebook's own internal research shows they are doing harm to societies and to individuals. You've heard it with the Facebook whistleblower and her recent testimony to the Senate. She calls it maybe social media's big tobacco moment when the truth comes out and accountability follows. Do you think that's what's happening now? Is this social media's big tobacco moment? Have you recently or in the past gotten off Facebook? Have you kept your kids off of social media? What difference did it make in your lives? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's what we're going to be talking about tomorrow, specifically about social media and what it would take to make it a big tobacco moment for the likes of Facebook et al. Today, again, we're talking about that connection between individual neurology, individual brains, and therefore the society that all of those brains, i.e. us, live in. And what are the forces that make people turn their backs on democracy? And I'm joined by Tim Snyder, professor of history at Yale, author of many books, and one of them is called On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Recently released, in fact, just this week, in a new graphic edition. It's terrific. Lisa Feldman Barrett joins us as well. She's a professor of psychology at Northeastern University, chief science officer for the Center for Law, Brain, and Behavior at Massachusetts General Hospital, author of a number of books, including 7.5 Lessons About the Brain and How Emotions Are Made. So, Lisa, Tim Snyder was talking about what he called basically the double negative of social media, that it both taxes our bodies as we consume it in terms of the attention draw, and then also, you know, provides an environment, an information environment that reduces uncertainty, because we've been talking a lot about that, by having like minds disinformation and untruth. So tell me, how is that all impacting the brain? I know that's a big question, but what's going on when we're immersed in that?
Yeah, so I think Tim is exactly right. And I want to build on what Tim said, because it's not just reducing uncertainty in the moment. And I should say, in the moment, uncertainty isn't necessarily a bad thing. If it was, we'd never learn anything or grow mm-hmm. and do anything different, right? It's that there's a cost that has to be repaid. And if the cost isn't being repaid, then, you know, there's a slow deficit being built up, which has a cost. But what I want to make the point is that when your brain really wires itself to the world, that is, you know, an infant brain is not a miniature adult brain. It's a brain that gets its wiring instructions from the world, the physical world of your body, and also the social world that we create. And for adults, it's the same thing. It's just, you know, the plasticity is a little slower, but the neurons in our brains are always foraging for information. They're always looking for new things to learn, if you will. And what happens if you are immersed in an environment, either because of your own choosing or because of how the algorithms of social media, that give you a tight single story, then that's what's going to be wired into your brain. And that's important because brains use that past experience to control action and create the experience of the present. So the person at the beginning saying, you know, I saw what I saw, that implies, a belief that your eyes are like a window onto the world. And that's not at all how the brain works. In fact, you know, in every moment, your brain is automatically using your past to predict the future, to control your body and create your experience in the present. So you see, your brain starts to prepare what you see before the information even reaches your eyes. Huh. And that's a really important point, that when you're immersed in social media with a single story, you're basically, your brain is being shaped to use that story in the future predictively, as a way of controlling your actions and experiencing the world.
Wow. Okay. Wow. So before I turn to the final part of the show, because I want to definitely hear from both of you about what do we do with this information? What do we do with this knowledge now? But before I do that, I can imagine that there are many listeners right now who are saying, you know, Meghna, this is just a highbrow excuse for inexcusable behavior, right? This is just a way to sort of to lighten the reality that there are certain Americans that just wish to undermine or overthrow our democracy, and they might just reject this analysis wholeheartedly. So, Lisa, specifically for you, and briefly, because I do want to spend a lot of time on solutions here, when we talk about the neurological shaping that can happen that leads to people to behave in an authoritarian or seek out authoritarian solutions, is it possible, regardless of where one falls on the political spectrum?
I think what I'm about to say is maybe sounds a little Pollyanna-ish, but I think that anybody, regardless of their predilections politically, there will be conditions where they will gravitate towards simple, single answers. Really, they'll avoid debate. They'll avoid diversity of thought. They'll be suspicious of other people who are different from them. I don't think that the left or the right owns this particularly. And I think, okay, sure, you know, there are always going to be people with nefarious motives, but I think the majority of people, when they find themselves in this kind of situation, it's usually because they're encumbered in some way. They're under considerable strain in some way. And so I think a certain degree of curiosity and compassion is not out of the question, even when people do things that, you know, you don't agree mm-hmm. with or you find really, really problematic, because that is the path to figuring our way out of this dilemma.
Yeah, I totally hear you on that. But I think a problem that makes that going down that path harder is Americans are ever more refusing to even be in those same spaces together,
for sure.
Right?
Absolutely.
Tim Snyder, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I would say, first of all, you know, we've identified, let's say, three problems: social media, wealth inequality, the lack of a welfare state. If we solved all of those problems, would Americans all be perfect angels of democracy? No. But would America be a sounder democracy, and would people in general behave better and in general have more time for one another and in general be better listeners and in general be more open to the facts? Yes. In general, they would be. So I would say, first, let's do all the things that we know would work, and then confront the issue, which I agree with you exists, of bad will. I mean, of course, there are people who don't like democracy. Of course, there are people who love authoritarianism. One of them was just the president of the United States. We got to watch it for 4 years and we're still watching it. So, of course, there's also a moral side to this. And when one speaks of institutions and one speaks about neurological structures, there's still something left over, which is ethics. Democracy is also an ethic. I think it's, even though I also think democracy leads to good outcomes, I have an ethical commitment to democracy. I think everyone has the right to be represented. And we can't leave that aside. That's, of course, also part of the picture.
Such an important point, right? Because that ethical commitment to democracy, I think one of the best ways for it to be demonstrated is through the very institutions of democracy. And the question is that happening now, or is it happening enough? So let me just play a little bit of tape here. This is, again, from January 6th.
They report everything. They're going to do vandalism.
No,
breakers vandalize anything.
That's what I'm saying. Like, if you break something, you are responsible.
We're all going to probably get in trouble for what we're doing.
All right, so that was Matthew Mazzucco on January 6th during the insurrection in a live stream inside the Capitol. Well, on October 4th, Mazzucco did get into trouble for what he did. In a case where prosecutors recommended 3 months of home confinement, U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan sentenced Mazzucco instead to 45 days in jail, explaining that, quote, "There have to be consequences for participating in an attempted violent overthrow of the government beyond sitting at home." So, Tim Snyder, tell me what you think about what role stable, democratically functioning institutions have in pushing back, I'm just going to put it this way, the manufactured uncertainty that authoritarians thrive on that we've been talking about.
Well, that's what democracy is all about. And that's one of the reasons why authoritarians around the world don't just try to overthrow democracy. They have a specific hostility towards democracy, because democracy precisely provides us with rhythm. Democracy tells us, if we don't like what's happening now, we're going to be able to vote in the future. Democracy tells us that if we don't like this party, the other party will eventually come to power. Democracy gives us a kind of predictable future. Authoritarianism can never do that, because authoritarianism will always be wrapped up in a particular person. And when he or she dies or is overthrown, then you'll have a terrible moment of uncertainty. So what authoritarianism offers is fake predictability. It offers fake certainty for a short period of time. That's its draw. What democracy offers is predictability over the long run. And in this way, it's healthy in some of the senses that Lisa has been talking about. And so the better democracy we can have, and our democracy is now very imperfect, especially with the ability, the equal right of people to vote, the better democracy we have, the more people believe that their vote counts and that they can vote, the better we'll also be doing in some of the kinds of things that have been concerning us in the show.
Okay, so the institutions themselves have a huge role to play here, but of course, individuals, people make up those institutions. So in the last couple of minutes, I want to talk about, again, where your two areas of expertise overlap in terms of what we as individuals can do. So let's just listen here for a second to Tina Grace, who told us about a time when a friend invited her to dinner.
This was right in the midst of the 2020 election. And we actually had a big political difference between the two of us. She was a really big Trump supporter and I am not. And she was reaching out to me, obviously, just to have a friendly dinner. And I had the decision to either have dinner with her or not. And I chose to have dinner with her, and it went better than expected. We did talk about politics a little bit, and I understood where she was coming from more after we decided to hear each other out and hear why we believe who we believed. And ultimately, although we think very differently politically, we still keep in contact to this day.
So I love this story because Lisa Feldman Barrett, as you know, in Tim Snyder's book on tyranny, he basically has 20 lessons or 20 points of action to take to push back on tyranny. And they range from the institutional, as we talked about, to something like make eye contact and small talk. And it's more than just being polite. Like something actually happens between people when they do that. So Lisa, I mean, what happens in the brains of individuals physically when we're making eye contact and talking with each other?
Yeah, well, we have this amazing capacity to, when we talk about connecting with each other, that's not just a metaphor. So we can, when we're in the same room with each other and we are communicating, we can, our breathing can synchronize, our heart rates can synchronize, our movements can synchronize. We regulate each other's attention by eye contact. Making eye contact can actually, you know, make someone pay more attention to you. It can direct what they pay attention to you, what they pay attention to, and so on. So in a very real way, we are the regulators and caretakers of each other's nervous systems as much as our own. And this is really important because it means that we are, even for the briefest moment, creating a social reality that is different from one where everyone is in their own little sort of informational silos. And I just want to make a point. We haven't really talked about social reality and what that is, but that, you know, almost everything we're talking about here, democracy, the presidency, politics, and so on, this is, you know, in the domain of social reality, where a group of people basically, by collective agreement, make up a reality, and then it becomes true. Like we impose the function of currency on little pieces of paper, and then poof, those mm-hmm. little pieces of paper have value, to trade for material right. goods, so much so that they influence,
everything.
People's actual. Yeah, exactly. And so when people talk to each other and when they communicate with each other, that is the basis of a more robust social reality.
Yeah.
When a president, you know, all of a sudden starts doing something that's different than other presidents did, and the public who elected that president don't do anything or by implicitly agree that it's okay, then in fact, by definition, it becomes okay because the rule is defined by social reality. And the only antidote there is for people to actually communicate with each other.
Well, Tim Snyder, I'm going to give you the last 20 seconds. That's literally all we have left. But what is the one thing you'd like people to go out and do after hearing this hour?
There was a great Czech philosopher who you talked about, Karel Kozik, who talked about the everyday smile. And he was a survivor of a concentration camp. If you can think like that, we can too. But while we're doing that, we also have to support with our networks the people who are doing the right thing. And for me, at the end of this conversation, the one thing I would emphasize is facts. We need to pay for facts. We need to help all the people who are trying to help us flood the world with facts. Thank you.
Well, Tim Snyder and Lisa Feldman Barrett, historian and neuroscientist, thank you so much for joining us today. This is On Point.